Good evening, everyone. Welcome to LSE Ideas and another webinar discussing important topics of the day. Today, we're very pleased to have Professor Jonathan Holzschlag and Dr. Leslie Thinjamuri speak and join us for a discussion of a book that Jonathan has written recently. This particular theme is addressed towards, is the West compliant in the resurgence of authoritarianism? A very topical and I would say controversial position on this question. As you know, the last decade has seen a global resurgence in authoritarianism. Democracy is in retreat and civil society is increasingly under attack. What had been proclaimed to be the end of history, at the end of the Cold War, seems to be receding into the distance, and the concurrent rise of China, a resurgent Russia under Putin, as well, have created a context where China and the United States are really enmeshed in a rivalry of what has been called strategic competition or competitors, systemic competitors as well, from another perspective. Beijing is being called out on issues such as human rights abuses, its role in Hong Kong, the South China Sea encounters. In short, China has been identified by the United States and the US-led global liberal order as a systemic rival. How did we end up in this place? It was not that long ago where they were seen to be China, the United States, and the global liberal order were seen to be working, if imperfectly, nonetheless, at least in lock, and if not step. So how did we get there? Jonathan Holzschlag will guide us in some of his thinking on that. Leslie and myself will speak to some of these issues, and we will open up the discussions more generally to the audience. Let me introduce the speakers first. Jonathan Holzschlag is a professor of international politics at the Free University in Brussels, where he teaches diplomatic history and international politics. He guest lectures at various civilian and military academies across the world and has advised European institutions, NATO, and national governments on international security. He's the author of several acclaimed books, including A Political History of the World, The Silk Road Trap, and China's Coming War with Asia. All of these have been translated into numerous languages. He's a frequent contributor to global media, CNN, BBC, CCTV, Al Jazeera, and writes as well for the news media, the Le Monde, Financial Times, and The Guardian. Dr. Leslie Thinjamuri is the director of the US and Americas program and dean of the Queen Elizabeth House Academy for Leadership in International Affairs at Chatham House. She's a frequent commentator on U.S. Foreign relations, and is a reader in international relations at SOAS University, and is indeed an advisor on the board here at LSE Ideas. So I'm the director, as I said, of LSE Ideas. Let me say no more about the people, and let's talk about the ideas that we are in fact here to discuss. Jonathan, if I could turn to you first, could you tell us why you thought this book was necessary, and this theme was necessary to draw on at this particular time? What inspired you?
Thank you, Chris, for that question, and thanks to the LSE, of course, for hosting. Well, the reason for me to write that book was a very practical one. Like you, I'm lecturing at the university, and I'm lecturing this course with a rather broad title, Contemporary Issues of International Relations, which essentially challenges me to give sense to the recent history of world politics since the end of the Cold War. And then, of course, if you start lecturing such a course, you scratch your head and you ask, what should I do with that? And then obviously a very recurrent theme and evolution throughout these 30 years was the growing pushback against the Western-led so-called liberal order, with the rise of authoritarianism around the Western world, but also, of course, the return of nationalism, protectionism and xenophobia increasingly in sight. That, of course, coinciding with a marked power shift, you can say, from the Euro-Atlantic basin towards the Asia-Pacific. So that I decided to embrace as the leitmotif, as the red line through that course. Besides that, I have been puzzled throughout my still juvenile career by the degree to which the West has been very familiar with the intentions and the ambitions and the concerns of authoritarian powers such as China. I have read throughout the last 20 years or so numerous reports, public and confidential ones, in which it was made very clear that China, for instance, was not willing to adjust to our normative agenda on human rights, on the political system, but also for the same token on its economic policy. It did make it very, very clear from the beginning that it did not want to backtrack on the objective and the desire to preserve the commanding height, so to say, over the economy, to continue to support strategic industries and so forth. So we knew all that right from the start. And when I dug into the archives, we essentially knew that China was not intended to change and adjust already from the 80s. The early encounters with the Chinese leadership back then, still Deng Xiaoping, by, for instance, Margaret Thatcher, were very, very, very clear. And the Chinese essentially said to her, you have your policy, we have ours, and we better learn to live with that. Then we had the Tiananmen uprising in 89. Same story. The West was very, very quick in trying to mend fences, restore relations, but China, and then it was under Jiang Zemin, also made it very, very clear and transparent that it would be open for business, but not that much for political engagement. And it continued throughout the years. And the more the partnership with China broadened and deepened, the more we had all these dialogues on a raft of issues, the more it became crystal clear that we were facing a rising power that, contrarily to the expectation of normative engagement, as it was called, we just stick to its line. We faced some moments of reflection in the early 90s, you can say, after Tiananmen, also at the point that the Western world, especially the United States, were hesitant about what to do on the trade level. Back then in the early 90s, there was the discussion about the so-called most favored nation treatment, which would give China very, very generous trade facilities. And you had back then in the United States, inside the White House, but also in Congress, this quite vivid discussion about whether they should really do that, because there was Tiananmen, there were new incidents with dissidents and new incidents of crackdown. But then still, in spite of the evidence going against China's desire to adjust, the Clinton administration decided to push this MFN treaty through. Same around the turn of the century, when we had, of course, China's interest to join the WTO. Then again, in the European Union and the United States, all these questions about human rights and should we trust China, that it would really genuinely open up the market, liberalize economically and so forth. Still, we let it enter into the WTO. And then when it really became evident that this was not just an emerging market, but an emerging market with a potential for huge dominance regionally and globally, we saw that after the turn of the century, internally, the Pentagon, for instance, but also the European Commission, became quite critical of the policy of constructive engagement, and also skeptical about China's desire and readiness to change and adjust. Yet even still, despite these misgivings, partially, for instance, I would say accelerated by the financial crisis and the Eurozone crisis, we still decided to go for pragmatism, if not optimism. So along the way, you can say that in the constructive engagements, the engagement was preserved, essentially economic engagement with a little slim layer of political engagement, but that it essentially was about business. And then when we got this decoupling, so to say, between the normative slash political part and the business part, we got to a situation in which we economically empowered a country that was firm in preserving its authoritarian line. We did so with our technology transfer, our investment, giving access to our market, so that now today we are facing a country in the Pacific with, of course, significant clout economically, politically, militarily, that now also as a result has, you can say, the influence not only to preserve internally its authoritarian system, but also subtly, I would say, still for the time being, propagated externally. So we essentially have made a competitor, an authoritarian competitor, very, very strong, especially, and I would reiterate that, in spite of knowing very, very well what was happening. And then we can apply that to China, but for the same token, also the resurgent Russia after the return of Putin or the arrival of Putin around 2000, some of the Gulf states and so forth. So what have we done? And especially, why didn't we change and reconsider when our diplomats and our intelligence services made it very manifest that a lot of the policy was not really, really functional? And that for me is the most salient part. Not the fact that China was so stubborn, but that we knew that all this was happening, and we knew that very, very well, it was very well documented, but that we refused to adjust policy.
Very, very, very well put, and very challenging for us. The Western governments, Western commercial interests, completely compliant with this, and knowingly so. I don't know. I've got some questions, but I know Leslie has done work on U.S.-China relations. Perhaps you want to comment.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say. There's so much in there. And I guess maybe a couple of places that I might begin. One is, if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly, Jonathan, one is that the big bet of liberal internationalism, that the liberal international order could be extended by including new states in the institutions that were so central during the Cold War that we, of course, extended and developed in the 1990s, that expansion of the international order, both institutionally and in terms of the instruments and in terms of at the hard edge, the humanitarian intervention side and direct support of human rights and civil liberties and toppling in some cases dictators and in some cases trying to build new nations, that big bet, and there are different parts of it, but that big bet largely failed. I mean, I'm reading you to say this, and especially that it failed on the question of turning China into a responsible stakeholder. Bob Zoellick's great thesis that by integrating China into the international institutions and especially the WTO in 2001, that China would change. And you know, I just went back before this panel to take a look at some of Zoellick's recent writings on this. He's spoken at Chatham House about a year ago. He's written about this. I would encourage all of the students online to read Robert Zoellick's, not only his original speech when he outlines the responsible stakeholder thesis, but importantly, the more recent writings where he says that those like Professor Holzlag who say that he was wrong and that it was wrong are misreading actually what's happened. Clearly, China has become a very serious challenger to many of the ambitions of the World Trade Organization. Clearly, China is not playing by the rules of international trade as the US and many Europeans and others would like it to. But nonetheless, his argument, and I think it's one that needs to be considered, is that for quite a long time, China played by far more rules and engaged in the international system far more than it would have otherwise done had it not been extended a hand by the so-called international community. And he points to things like China's support of UN peacekeepers, China's support of many UN Security Council resolutions, and a number of other interesting types of engagement that are, you know, very concrete. So, which is why I think it's important to look to. Now, I'm not saying that I subscribe to the overall point. I tend to be more on the side of, you know, we should have taken deterrence. And I think there was a deterrence line, even in all of this liberal internationalism that was driving a lot of the thinking. But it's very easy to look back and to say, gosh, the liberal international bet failed. And let's remember that it didn't fail everywhere and it didn't fail immediately. So the first big bet was, do you expand NATO to include some of the formerly members of the Warsaw Pact? It's hard, you know, that was a robust conversation, obviously, in Washington. There are many distinguished professors at the LSE who have debated this, not least with respect to its implications for Russia. But the bet was not only that would do more for the international system, it was also that it would do more to secure democracy at home in those countries, right? The institutions were not only there for foreign policy, they were there to secure transitions. And this goes to John Eikenberry's thesis, which is that the international liberal order was devised to protect democracy and civil society, especially in the early post-war years. And so I think it's reasonable, actually, that in 1990, when the US looks triumphant, when the West looks triumphant, when there are plenty of reasons for optimism, that a very powerful line of thinking had a lot of empirical weight behind it and said, actually, let's give this a run for its money. They didn't listen to the realists at the LSE or, you know, in Washington. There weren't as many realists in Washington, but there were plenty in the United States. But I don't think you could throw the whole thing out, right? And I guess the second thing I would say is, you know, it's then a question of which measures worked and which didn't. And one question is, you know, including China in some of the institutional frameworks, certainly the WTO, and engaging more generally, as opposed to perhaps a harder form of deterrence earlier on. A second question is, you know, did the U.S. fail? And I would argue at the moment it's being too soft on institutions in Asia. So you can use institutions not only to include, you can use institutions to create new norms, create liberal spaces in order to shape the politics and the economic exchange in a region. And that's what I believe the U.S. should be doing in Asia right now. It should get into CPTPP. It shouldn't leave that space open for China and others to create those rules and norms and standards and decision-making procedures. So I think institutions are tremendously valuable for claiming that liberal space. It's just a question of what you do with them, how you use them, how you penalize those who don't play by the rules. But again, I wouldn't throw it all out. And I think it was a decent bet to think that you can use institutions to alter incentives and to change behavior, which isn't to say that we got it right every time. Our leaders clearly didn't. And maybe, you know, there's so much to say, but maybe I'll just say two more things very quickly. One is, you know, support of civil society was something that was clearly part of the Helsinki process throughout the Cold War. It didn't, you know, I don't think that very many people would argue that in and of itself brought the wall down, changed, transformed the international system. But I do think that people think it was really important and that it was important for multiple reasons. And those lessons, I think, have, you know, become a foundational lesson that drove a lot of the ongoing investment in civil society in the post-Cold War period and since. And the question then is, you know, why did we step into that game and add military force and military intervention in the case of some weak states? And in some very contentious areas to do things that we were never capable of doing and poorly equipped to doing, and probably led to a really serious backlash in multiple cases that arguably has done more harm than good. And we know some of the cases, and some of them are live and some of them aren't. But there are all sorts of debates. And again, I'd be reluctant to say the West has always failed and always been complicit in the resurgence of authoritarianism. And I'd be really, really supportive of a framework that said, you know, where has it worked and where has it failed and why? And to, again, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because we don't have very many instruments for influencing international relations. And, you know, if you just listen to Biden's speech at the UN General Assembly this afternoon, we're told, and I think it's a good lesson, let's stay away from the military force, except for, you know, deterrence or coercive diplomacy. And let's do development and diplomacy and humanitarianism and any other number of things. And then my final point is that, you know, the big problem is, you know, the global economy has clearly not delivered. And that is clearly, and you pointed to this, and I think really well throughout your book, you know, that I think is one of the big failures. We lost a very serious and luminary scholar who's taught us so many lessons on this just in the last few days. We lost John Ruggie, and there's nobody who better equipped to tell us about embedded liberalism. And, you know, the transformation of the global economy and its impact on democracy at home, not only across the globe, but certainly in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and across much of Europe. We know the consequences of that for liberalism, for liberal democracy. And I think that's what, you know, that's one of the areas for redress now. But it's, you know, but was it, again, don't throw it out. Capitalism has done many good things. But how do you refine it and channel it so that it bolsters rather than undermines liberal forces in our society?
Great. A defense of the liberal order and the choices there, Jonathan, over to you.
Well, thank you, Leslie, for a lot of these insightful comments. And I agree with you that in our assessment, we should indeed try to stay balanced and sophisticated. A couple of spontaneous thoughts. First of all, was it a matter of hindsight wisdom, so to say? And wasn't it normal, given the optimism in the 90s, to take on China that way and perhaps be a bit more focused on the success and the engagement part than all the difficulties? I think so. It's evident for rich and powerful societies that they are a bit more forthcoming, so to say, and more lenient in their external policy. I think that's evident when you grow stronger, and certainly when you get the preponderance that the United States and the West, by extension, enjoyed in the 90s, you become a little bit more flexible and forthcoming, because of course also some of the asymmetries in the partnership at that stage do not have to be considered as a security issue or something that existentially threatens, for instance, the social project at the center of world politics. So in a way, I can understand. Yet, I believe that the more you read into the diplomatic archives, and I've also done some more specific papers on the China engagement, the more also you reconstruct the debates that we had back then in Congress and in some of the EU parliaments, that the reservations were quite substantial, and that also the intel we had about, for instance, China's economic policy and China's domestic policy desires was very persuasive. And it seems to me that often, despite this burden of the proof, so to say, on the side of that was more favorable on the side of the skeptics, the politicians decided to, by and large, ignore that, or at least they didn't give it its merited attention, I would say. And that, of course, leads us to the question again, why? To some degree, indeed, perhaps there was this innate expectation that China could be changed. But that too can be challenged, because if you read in the biographies of George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton, it becomes very clear that they too had doubts that Clinton, for instance, was on record saying, "I hate this China policy because it's so unbalanced, because there is such a lack of reciprocity." So was it kind of forward-leaning engagement, voluntarism in a way? I don't think we can we can really corroborate that. We cannot really support this point entirely with the evidence that we have at hand. So hindsight wisdom, I don't know. China and institutionalism. It's true indeed that from the 90s the Chinese joined a lot of institutions and became, for instance, much more engaged in international governance than, for instance, a peer such as India. But then also always with a very clear agenda of selective engagement. If you look at the WTO, it clearly benefited from the rules in liberalizing trade in goods. But then obviously at the same time, it resisted liberalization in other domains, trade and services, investment, and so forth. So it selectively exploited, I would say, the WTO for the purpose not really of genuinely opening up, but continuing a kind of export promotion that was very much government supported. And that was premised on growing strong national industry. So I think whenever the Chinese accepted cooperation in international organization, this kind of internationalism was just a means to get to the goal of comprehensive national power and just the strength of the Chinese state and the Communist Party. So is the glass full or half full? I just think oftentimes we misread the ambition and the intention behind China's internationalist engagement. I think China was always hard-nosed realism with a little facade of internationalism and then increasingly apt, I would say, at turning some of this international institutionalism against the West. I think it really exploited the WTO framework in a way that it became harmful for Western economic interests. And in that regard, I understand a bit why Donald Trump, in his own clumsy way, got fed up with it, as Obama, by the way, also was before him. So have we failed? Have we succeeded? I think when it comes to China, of course, we can take pride in the fact that China has done so much to combat poverty, for instance, and that altogether it is still authoritarianism, but still with quite a lot of restraint. We haven't seen this kind of Maoist and adventurism, this exporting of revolution. And in that regard, indeed, stability and internal stability helps build, at least in the short term, a bit more international stability, or at least predictability. But still, for me, the fact that now you have a power gaining so much influence and weight economically, in the long run, I think will prove quite destabilizing. And for me, the problem is not so much China's growth as such, but the very fact that it's increasingly unbalanced. And then we can, of course, talk about the recent Australia-US-UK partnership and a bit about the Quad. But the fact remains that this kind of power shift in China's advantage regionally and globally continues, that efforts or at least plans to reorient some of the economic engagements towards struggling democracies, and I would put India up front, but you also have quite a few in Southeast Asia, is not really happening if you look at the data in terms of FDI, in terms of trade, and so forth. So I am concerned that this rising authoritarian juggernaut, so to say, unchecked, in the future will start to throw its weight around, as most of the other rising powers have done in the past. And that leads me perhaps to a final point, that is that One concern is, of course, the rise of an authoritarian power. The other concern, as you also iterate, Leslie, is that throughout the last 30 years, we might have not done enough to fortify our democracy inside out. With that, I mean that it was, of course, at some points all too evident to relocate production and activities to China and not really to reinvent the market internally. And to reinventing, I mean creating an economy in the Euro-Atlantic world in the West that, of course, would be more sustainable, would embrace human dignity more prominently, and would make sure that productivity gains would be sustained and also properly redistributed among the people. And in that regard, indeed, I believe that there is a lot of merit in this concept of embedded liberalism. I think in the age of neoliberalism, we went way too far in just letting it go. And for the government also to say, let the market regulate themselves, but in a context in which, of course, a lot of our trade partners didn't have any desire to play it by the rules of the market. So how can we return to a kind of embedded liberalism that still gives, I would say, scope to entrepreneurialism, to creativity in the traditional liberal way, for the market to be free to some degree, but then also to make sure that it is humane and that it continues to mirror the values that we hold close to us. Does that exclude cooperation with China? No, but I do believe that that might be a starting point to make it more balanced. To come to the conclusion, yes, of course, there are some positive achievements indeed, but there are also a lot of imbalances. And what really worries me is that certainly in Europe, we still have a lot of difficulties to get to grips with that. And even in the United States, I would say that despite all the pressuring and the deterrence that is being built up, that if you look at the level of low politics, of business exchanges, of trade, still Washington has a lot of difficulties to rebalance that. So that while we, on the one hand, try to push China back, at least the Americans, that on the other hand, we still try to make it very, very rich through the imbalanced trade. And I think COVID through AliExpress and Amazon and so forth might even have accelerated that. And for the European Union, I'm even less encouraged that we are going to come up with any policy that would testify of some more geopolitical maturity, or how do they call it, open strategic autonomy these days.
Can I jump in and say, so if liberal institutions are not, global liberal institutions are not seen to be fit for purpose here, is that the reading that I hear from both of you, that they are served a purpose, but in the context of great power competition as is manifesting, particularly I'm thinking the WTO was something that was constructed after, though it built on the past, it was built in a world where United States preeminence was a given, and did not even have some of the checks and balances that were part and parcel of the first institutions of the post-World War II order. So I'm just wondering, is the diagnosis of how do we get out of this dilemma that is being posed here of authoritarianism on the rise and China's role, that are liberal institutions going to provide the solution, or are they not capable as actors in this? Do we need to reconstruct the institutions in order to account for changing global environment, strategic environment as well? So it's a question really for both of you.
Great question. I take a stab at that because I also have a couple of things I wanted to say in response to Jonathan's remarks. I mean, the first thing I would say is I'm really hesitant to kind of make the ground sweeping statement, because first of all, it's really hard to build institutions. And, Suzanne Nossel wrote a great chapter in our recent publication, Anchoring the World, and she wrote about reviving the UN. And she said, be careful what you wish for, get rid of it, and you're going to start building it back all over again. So we all know that UN reform is basically impossible, but building a new UN is probably even harder. So to that end, I would say, some institutions work better than others. And I don't mean that in any kind of flippant way, but I think it requires very careful diagnosis. And also we need we have multiple instruments out. We don't have that many instruments of statecraft. Institutions are a very important one. And I think the trick is to work out how to use them and how to adapt them. And that, as we know, is incredibly hard. But having survived 4 years of a US presidency led by a president who really didn't believe in the collective, in the collaborative, in the show of diplomacy, in the symbolism of turning up, I think that in my estimation, that was that did us very little good and a lot of harm. So I am not an opponent of having liberal institutions. I just think we have to think very carefully about how to use them. I also wanted to point out a couple things, though. Again, and I guess I would go back to the 1990s. It's very easy. I think it's too easy to look back and say, gosh, we got it so wrong. And it's important to remember a couple of facts. And so I wish I had one in my hands, but I don't. I was trying to look up what was China's GDP in 1990. Okay. I don't know if either of you remember, but it was not very much relative to what it is today. And it was not
in the top 10 leading countries for sure.
You are a U.S. decision maker, and you've just, you're telling yourself the story. We've just won the Cold War, and you're looking out at a country that doesn't play by the rules, and you want to kind of influence it, and you feel like you're sort of riding a wave. It's not unreasonable in the distribution of power such as it existed. And remember that people had at one stage been very worried about Japan, and that didn't turn out to be the great worry that people thought it might be. So it wasn't an unreasonable bet to think that some of these mechanisms that were floating around and that had been heavily invested in for over seven decades and that had done quite a lot of good in Europe and in the transatlantic space might be an instrument worth trying. And, just remember that China then isn't what China is now. And the second thing that's just radically different and a game changer that I don't think it would have been reasonable to expect anybody to anticipate, and that is the technology that we now have, not least the internet, artificial intelligence, automation more generally, quantum computing, and so on and so forth. So all of these things have radically changed the game, but even in the short term, just the social media revolution is not something that I think our leaders could have comprehended, and that matters clearly, very specifically in the context of did they do enough to protect democracy at home? I think perhaps we can assign more blame on the sort of the enthusiasm for getting rid of or letting capital controls slip out of our sight and the Washington consensus. But then that layered on top of a fractured media environment that was made possible by technological change that we simply couldn't have anticipated. That's a game-changing dynamic that I think that hindsight is 2020, but looking forward, it was not in the 1990s. But to your question, I guess I've sort of answered your question. Would I get rid of institutions? I absolutely wouldn't. No, and I actually think it matters. Despite all the hypocrisy that we associate with the U.S. when it comes to whatever your views are in Afghanistan, of sometimes working with allies and sometimes not. If you're France, you're not very happy right now. But I still think it matters that Joe Biden went to the UN and made the case for what he intends to do and how much money he intends to commit and what he hopes to get other people to do by making that very public speech and giving some sort of voice to people that are on that side of the issues. So the institutions matter for all sorts of reasons, but I think we have to get pretty granular before we start taking the axe and getting rid of any of them, because God forbid you'd have to start over again.
Thank you. It's my turn, I guess. Well, perhaps a little bit more, because it's a very intriguing part of our discussion. Was it normal for us to have so or such high hopes for China to change? And indeed, if we return to the 90s, China's GDP, I think, was 10 times smaller than that of the United States still. But if you, again, go to the archives and especially if you read what some of the declassified memos and intel products stated at that time, it was very, very clear. Huh? In the early 90s, for instance, we had growing tensions over, for instance, Taiwan, the Taiwan Missile Strait crisis. There was growing trade friction already back then. We have literally intelligence services warning as early as 1995 for the betrayal of constructivist engagement, for the decoupling between the political agenda and the trade agenda. We have in 1996 an intelligence estimate of the CIA, which states that China is going to lay low for a while, but as soon as it grows more powerful, it will continue to do what it has on its political agenda, but of course with much more influence. And it continues to see the West as the main obstacle, and I quote, preventing Beijing from reassuming its historical place as the paramount power of Asia. Now, of course, it's perhaps even legitimate for China to seek to become the paramount power in Asia. But I would just stress again that there is a huge body of evidence building up, especially as a lot of this stuff gets declassified, of the awareness that was there in different pockets of the government about the very fact that this constructive engagement was just not working already as early as the 90s. And then if you go through the memoirs of the people in charge back then, secretaries of state, presidents, they will avow even in many ways that they did not feel entirely comfortable with the China partnership. And perhaps it's not just a matter of putting blame on certain people, but just to conclude or to derive from this episode that just in international politics, it's not evident to change track. That oftentimes we have this idea that through diplomacy we can make and shape, but that track dependency is something very, very difficult to escape from. And then on liberal institutionalism, I would start answering that question by iterating that the main liberal institution is just still our democracy at home, right? And I think we cannot entertain any hope or expectation whatsoever to preserve international liberal institutions if we do not do a good job in restoring democracy at home. And that's really the main battleground, if we can use that term, where we have to show to the rest of the world that democracy remains something very, very, very precious. How do we do that? Well, it comes with a lot of different tenets of policy, education, I think, and investing more in civic education, for instance, is one of my pet topics. But also creating this marketplace that rewards positive entrepreneurialism. And that comes, I think, with a more solid trade policy, not the kind of Trumpian trade policy. But we do have to make sure that we protect our companies vis-a-vis different forms of state capitalism that turn dictatorship and pollution and these things into a competitive advantage. Because if we do not do that, we will continue to lose power. We will continue to lose jobs, opportunities to create jobs and just prosperity and lose public support for this very system. So I think we are in a tough fight for preserving democracy at home, really. And it's a kind of enlightened power politics. I think power still matters a great deal, economic power, political power, but enlightened in a way that we now cannot let the ideal slip, because the more I talk to politicians and also especially people in the business world, they say, well, in the 21st century, we might just have to let the liberal agenda go. This is a luxury. We should go for the raw, naked power and business. I think that would be very, very dangerous, because the West actually might lose itself in this turbulent power politics. And I think it will be very difficult to compete with the authoritarians if we do no longer know what ties us together. In terms of international liberalist institutions, I think they will only be useful and powerful if they are backed up by resilient Western states and nations, evidently. So that's important. And then I think also, well, when it comes to, for instance, the WTO, I really believe that we should make sure that we do not allow countries to engage in a kind of selective, predatory, and I would say even harmful way, as China did in the last decades. Because I think essentially allowing countries in that do not fully subscribe to the agenda, that's kind of self-defeating. And perhaps we can understand a little bit why in the 1990s we were a bit more tolerant and pragmatic. But today, like, the WTO has lost its significance, both for the Chinese, at least to some point, and also for the United States, because even after Trump, the Biden administration is still very reluctant to significantly invest in its reconstruction, I would say. And then perhaps essentially use liberal institutionalism to reach out to countries that still have some dedication to the liberal values. I would say again that there are still a lot of struggling democracies around, like I would say hovering between authoritarianism on the one hand, which becomes more interesting for them as China served as a role model, and then still, especially in the broader layers of their population, interest for democracy. What can we do through these liberal institutions to support them? And can we perhaps divert some of the trade and the investment back from the authoritarians to those? Like, think of Tunisia, think of Lebanon. These are small, tiny countries in our orbit that I think merit our support. And if we could use liberal institutions to engender change in those places, I think we would be much more effective. What do we do with India, right? It's very easy now for us to say, yeah, well, with Narendra Modi, India is a lost case and it will slide into authoritarianism as well. I think it would be a catastrophic mistake if we do not use our institutions, our liberal institutions, WTO, IMF, World Bank, and so forth, to help avoid that India backslides. Because from a realist viewpoint, it would prevent us of having a serious Asian counterweight against China. And from a normative perspective, I think it would be a devastating blow to democracy if India would slip. So yes, liberal institutions are important, but we might have to use them a bit more sophisticatedly.
I want to say one word. Can I say one word, Chris?
One word, and then we have quite a number of questions.
Oh, sorry. Just very quick on India, and I guess this is a problem that sits there. Clearly, there's a lot of strategic thinking on how to engage India with respect to the China challenge, and the Quad is one format. There are others. This goes back to George W. Bush and the U.S.-India Strategic Partnership. But the question is, how do you do that? You know, not only on liberal issues like technology, cooperation, and vaccines, and the positive agenda that we've seen coming out of the Quad, but how do you do it to actually also address the internal issues? And that's, I think, where the hesitancy and where it's just much harder challenge because of the overarching strategic framework and concern that if you go down that road, then you lose India as a partner in solving the global public goods challenges and especially the China challenge. So I don't have an answer to that, but it's clearly one of the most pressing dilemmas that exists when it comes to deploying these institutions and working with, you know, India, as you say, those vital partners.
So we have actually quite a number of questions. I'm going to not be able to get all of them, but I'm going to do my best. This is one that by Philip Lismont, and it speaks to a few of the issues we were just addressing. He asks, how would we deal with the contradiction in defending the merits of Western liberalism by actively reducing liberal engagement? This seems to be an existential challenge. So he's asking the question is, that some of the assumptions which are part of the liberal international order require change. That's that, as I understand it, he's reading your thesis, Jonathan, and saying that we need to, that combating, as he puts it, combating authoritarian regimes will require tempering assumptions of the liberal international order. And that there'll be sort of nationalist state-led trade. It's decoupling is also a byproduct of that and the like. So how do we deal with the contradictions that, and yet still be seen to be defending the order, the internet, the fundamental values which both of you have spoken to?
And that's a very, very exciting question from, I believe, one of my very, very good students. I'm so happy to see him participating here. Well, it's indeed it's going to be a very difficult balancing exercise because in the analysis that I, for instance, make, there is indeed a risk of entrenchment, a risk of also going a bit all too far the realist slash nationalist road. Now, let me make very clear that I'm not against international engagement in no way, but I do believe that all engagement has to be conditional. Engagement for me is not an end in itself. Engagement from the perspective of a society is a means, very important one, to first of all help preserve the goals, objectives, ideals that you embrace internally as a society, to work towards stability around. And then also, and that's perhaps a bit my realist instinct, that in spite of trying to propagate your influence, you also make sure that you gain sufficiently in the long run, not only short-term gains from cooperation. So how can we deal with that? First things first, I think that for the West today, it's indispensable that we firm up who we are, right? I think it's more important than ever before that we tell what we stand for. I think it's important for the sake of social cohesion. It's important also, I believe, for our position as an international actor, but we have to stand to explain better what values and ideas we stand for. And then I think you just have to pick your partnerships better, which means that if you engage the world, try to engage as much as possible those countries that hold the potential and have an interest to come to do things that go at least to some point to your values and ideals. And we cannot change things overnight. Change is something very slow, and especially as Leslie also said, democratization, it took us like centuries. We cannot expect that for other countries to happen from the one day to the other, but the trajectory has to be clear, and the steps in a positive direction have to be there. So let's shift a little bit this tilt towards authoritarianism in a lot of, I would say, essentially European partnerships, increasingly so. And try to see whether we can do things more with countries such as India, Japan, South Korea, some of the Southeast Asian countries, for instance, also very, very important. And especially, I would say, countries close to us, because what I really fear is that in our loose global engagement, we might completely lose influence also in our backyard, and that would be a very, very strategic mistake. So let's resist isolationism, let's resist protectionism, but just choose and define our partnerships a little bit more selectively.
Great. There's another question from Hugh McCarthy, and in fact, it's something I was going to ask you, so I'll say it in his words, though. Would a democratic China seeking to we expect a democratic China to seek to remake the international order as the United States once did? In other words, is the issue authoritarianism here, and we're responding, but wouldn't we find the same pattern if the liberal expectations of China had been realized by this time? And so just to your reading of that.
You want me to take on it, but perhaps Leslie also has some thoughts, and then I can follow.
That's it. Leslie, how do you feel? Shall I first cut?
Sure, I want to make sure I understood the question. So if China was actually a democracy, would it actually behave any differently? Or is it just a great power competition that's sort of a realist great power competition?
The certainties of realism would suggest that even a democratic China would behave this way.
I mean, undoubtedly, it wouldn't be simple. Having a democratic, extraordinarily powerful, driven, ambitious, attract a China that was actually less threatening and more attractive to its regional partners and to people around the world. I think that would, that would make the US and others feel insecure for any number of reasons, not least and especially competitive ones. But I don't think it would be the same. And there would potentially be the possibility and the prospect for a huge amount of benefit and gain if one had the confidence to trust that economic exchange and access to Chinese consumers and Chinese capital and Chinese investment would be regulated fairly or fairly enough by a set of rules that could be adjudicated when they were broken. I think that would be game changing. But that doesn't mean that it would be easy and that wouldn't be extraordinarily competitive and that there wouldn't still be issues of miscalculation, misperception, and all the rest of it to manage. There would be, but it would be different. But that's at least how I think about that question.
Jonathan, do you want to weigh in on that?
No, I largely agree with Leslie's assessment. To say that democracies don't fight is perhaps too much of an exaggeration, but I do indeed believe that there is slightly greater restraint. But it remains a fact that powers, whatever form of government they display, grow more arrogant when they gain clout. We have many city states and countries in the past that were republics, for instance. Think of Rome and its clash with Carthage. Think of Athens, that also tended to be quite belligerent. Of course, they believed that they stood for justice and for the republican spirit. But they also became quite belligerent. What I am worried about, disregarding whether China is a democracy or not, is a China as a Eurasian juggernaut that remains unchecked. And I think what we have today with China powering ahead and the rest of Asia, including Southeast Asia or ASEAN and South Asia, especially India, not following, that worries me, because you get such imbalances if this trend persists that it almost becomes inevitable that if it's not towards the United States, then at least towards its neighbors, China will display the kind of hubris that at least we today are being forced to come to grips with in the West. So yes, democracy modifies, but at the end of the day, if you have a a power or a country with the potential that China has, and such an asymmetric growth and success, it becomes destabilizing.
I mean, it's interesting, and I share this view, and I think that the South China Sea issue would not look necessarily that different in the sense of the aspirations of China in that area, and the desire to have the United States, if not retreat, at least certainly reduce its positioning there. So that's amongst other things. We have some other questions here. Let me, this is one from Kathmandu. To Professor Jonathan, what sort of threats are observed by the West from China, and why is the West so tough on matters of politics in China?
Okay, well, actually, I don't think that we have been that tough when it comes to Chinese domestic politics or the Hong Kong issue or the Uyghur issue. We have been vocal about it, even I believe that we could have been more vocal, but we have raised the matter a few times, but we haven't imposed any sanctions. The only genuine sanction that is still in place is the arms embargo, and even that with limitations, because we still, I think, trade for about 200 million annually in defense goods with China. That's the arms embargo after imposed after the Tiananmen uprising. So I would dispute a little bit that we have problems with that we are tough on China's domestic politics. It's just not really the case, and the Chinese also know that we are not going to be very, very tough. I think an interesting case is going to be the adventures of tiny little Lithuania with Taiwan recently. Of course, by China, that's considered a domestic affair. But are the other European countries going to stand by Lithuania, and in which way? So yeah, my answer would be that we have not been tough, and that in spite of a lot of things not going into the direction of the constructive engagement agenda, we have been very loath to change track ourselves.
I mean, certainly many sinologists would say that the absence of a tough and declarative approach here has weakened, has reinforced the notion of a West as weak, and that it plays into a general belief in the malaise of the West and democracy and the like. If you can't defend your own values and interests, then what can you defend? So I think that that's contributed to that debate.
I think it's absolutely true. And there are two sides, two dimensions to it. First of all, I think we have betrayed on a lot of the reformists in China, and that's what they tell themselves. You have let us down, whether it concerns economic liberals in China that feel abandoned and have been feeling abandoned throughout, especially after the turn of the century. Or whether it concerns dissidents, or for the same token, some of the activists in Hong Kong, it is delegitimizing the West as a partner of democracy. The same mistake, by the way, we made during and after the Arab Spring. So I think we really undermine our credibility. By the way, it's even more important because, like, the EU is treaty bound to protect and advance human rights and democracy in its foreign policy. Amsterdam and Maastricht treaty are very, very clear about that. So this kind of foreign policy violates our own constitutional treaties, our own political DNA, you can say. So that's a first very important observation that I wanted to make. And then I think for the second, I got lost in my argumentation, but it will come back.
Well, while you're thinking of it, Leslie, did you want to come in on any of those issues?
I mean, I guess picking up on what Jonathan said about, you know, I'm always perplexed by this, you know, because hypocrisy is rampant in everybody's foreign policy and everybody's engagement. So at what point does, you know, is there too much hypocrisy and you do actually erode any sense those on the receiving end that you really are willing to stand up for your values? And as soon as you're a large power with multiple competing interests and limited resources, and you put forward a set of principles and values, then there's always going to be hypocrisy, because there are, in my view, always trade-offs to be made. So I think it's, you know, an inherent dilemma, and many people believe that hypocrisy, you know, still talking the talk, even when you sometimes selectively don't walk the walk, it still serves a useful function because it gives voice to, you know, lots of people that believe in those values. But obviously that runs out at a certain, you know, the question is when it runs out. And I think it's a really tough debate. So, you know, I don't have a great answer. I think that what we're seeing right now is a U.S. that's actually very driven to be strategic and pragmatic and is realist in the execution of its principles and its strategic priorities. And that inevitably means that, you know, democracy isn't going to always get front and active support, democracy promotion. So it's going to be complicated for sure. And there will be people who are disappointed, but I still think it's better to have it out there than to not have it out there at all. I wouldn't want to live in a world where nobody wanted to put their values out there unless they could be absolutely consistent in supporting them. That would be quite a bleak world, because there would simply be no values articulated in international affairs.
Yes, indeed. I've got Fernando Herrero saying, suggesting that we should suspend the category of the West and talk about the U.S. as a starting point. Also, what are the options for the liberal Leviathan? What are the options to the liberal Leviathan and a realist position of the U.S. first? So I wonder if maybe that's a Leslie question first. If I understand it correctly, it's first just denying this idea of the West and saying it's really America first at this stage and the U.S. as a leader. Where does that put us?
I mean, the West is a complicated concept. I'm filled with regret every time I use it, because I'm not entirely sure. It means many different things to many different people. It means geography to some people, or it has a geography basis that's largely, you know, in the U.S. and Europe. For others, it's a set of values, and it exists across many societies, but it's not bounded by state borders. And so I think part of the problem in using the concept of the West is that we just don't all mean the same thing. But most often, what most people seem to mean is the United States and Europe. And if that's what we mean, then it's actually not a very useful concept. We could just say, you know, the transatlantic space. But there is something that it captures in terms of a set of aspirations that, you know, go back to the Enlightenment, and that project a set of values and commitments that I think isn't what the U.S. is, and it's different from the U.S. So I think differentiating between them is important. But is the U.S. just about America first? Well, I mean, yes and no, but, you know, yes, obviously the U.S. is, you know, doing a lot of things in a pretty hard-edged way, but it's obviously not just about America first, or why in the world would they put so much into the kinds of global public good commitments that Biden's right now talking about investing in and making pledges to. And, you know, there's still a lot that goes beyond that, even if it looks pretty hard-edged, given how high our expectations have been once Trump left office and there was a Democrat back in town.
Yeah, I don't know, Jonathan, if you want to follow up on as well.
Yeah, well, I agree that it's not going to be that black and white. But I do believe that we have reached a watershed when it comes to the history after the great revolutions of the 18th century. This long trajectory from those revolutions towards where we are today. Will we be able to preserve, consolidate, reinvent eventually? And how? Because you see that trust in and support for democracy is slowly, not dramatically, but slowly starting to retreat in the West as well. I'm not saying that this is kind of the beginning of a doomsday scenario, but we should be very, very careful about that. And okay, we have today a Biden administration that is more forthcoming and likable, at least from the viewpoint of the EU. But how about the undercurrent in the US, and how about the undercurrent politically and socially in the EU? And then again, I would advocate for enlightened power politics. I think we have to preserve in the first place the power to maintain the freedom of action, the sovereignty, the independence to make our democratic choices in the future. And what then does that mean? And there comes this balance between pragmatism and idealism in foreign policy. I think indeed that you cannot just completely project your ideals on the rest of the world. But I do believe that if you're in government, you have to communicate in a measured and balanced way about that. Not as we did in the last few decades to really champion ourselves as the guardians of liberalism and human rights. The EU still does that, by the way. Just read into von der Leyen's State of the Union last week. And then to come up with a policy that goes the other way around. I think then you should also have to explain to your people and the rest of the world that we stand for certain ideals, but that we cannot achieve everything. So I believe a more measured and balanced tone in the foreign policy discourse is very important, because otherwise you disillusion both your constituencies at home and some of your partners abroad. Second, I believe that what we have to mind much more in international politics, and also in light of this power shift that goes on, is low politics. I think China and Russia and all the others, they do not so much advance their influence summit after summit, submarine after summit. No, they advance their influence container after container that is being exported to Europe or the West. Oil barrel after oil barrel. That's essentially generating the power shift. That is generating the changes in terms of trade, financial flows that are the basis, the fundaments on which they build political and military power shifts. And what I sense, whether it concerns discussions with my American colleagues or here in Brussels or with member states, is that we're getting very much focused on high politics and all the things that are strategic, military, sensitive stuff, but that we still do not have an answer for that low politics. And I think as long as we have these two kind of flows or currents disconnected from each other, I think a lot of your authoritarians will, or competitors will win. It's of course not evident to get to grips with trade imbalances, because it implies certain corrections and adjustments that also consumers have to undergo. And that's not evident. But I really believe that when it comes to preserving power, that's where one of the main battles is, or at least one of the main challenges lies.
Yeah, I also would add that, just coming back to the issue of the West and conceptualization, that if we use that language, I think the largest democracy is not in this geographic territory. Japan has been a democratic state and supporter for well over 70 years, and Korea and so on, and so South Korea. So we do a disservice to democracy by employing this term. So we need to keep that in mind. Mariah Thornton has a couple of questions. One of them here is, do you think the new defense pact, AUKUS, will be impactful in terms of containing or limiting the power of authoritarian countries in the Indo-Pacific region? And if so, what forms do you think that will take?
Yeah. Okay. I think that pact is it's largely symbolical. for the reason that UK actually doesn't have a significant bunch in the Indo-Pacific, and that also Australia's role is limited. It's kind of more a support for the United States posture there than it is substantial, okay, in the domain of Intel, for instance. It might be a bit more useful, but altogether, I think its impact will be limited. I repeat what I said before. For me, really, the only way to rebalance China or rebalance the landscape in Asia, let me put it that way, not necessarily to contain China, but to make sure that the balance of power is preserved, is to have a kind of quad-like formation. And then not only quad in the realm of defense and military affairs, but I think also quad in economic terms, which means that we have to work with India, whatever the difficulties are, to help industrialize that country and make sure that essentially the rapidly growing population has more employment opportunities. That's essential. Then I think also synergy with ASEAN is going to be essential. There is a struggle for life, you can say, between ASEAN, the 10 Southeast Asian countries, as an internal market on the one hand, and China on the other. Like the last 20 years, China diverted a lot of trade and industrial activity away. We have to help ASEAN to preserve its cohesion. So I think that's really what we need. Are we going to deliver? I don't know. I do not see a lot in the pipeline of very, very concrete, substantial things that might change that. Of course, we have the American and European visions for connectivity now as a counterweight to the Belt and Road Initiative, but the budgets, at least as I can see what is committed, are going to be quite limited. You're going to we have different trade agreement and trade constructions in the pipeline, but still that too will require the resolve to reduce dependency from China, and not only in the sector of high tech, but also the production change more broadly. Australia, UK, US, it's nice to have, but it's certainly not enough.
Hi, Chris, I'll just add one thing on that, which is, I think it's true that pact, it will take quite a long time for it to come to fruition. But I do think that it's significant because it will complicate China's efforts to have influence and power in the sea. It will complicate communications. It sends a very strong signal as to, you know, Australia's positioning. And it's, you know, it reads as being a clear response to China's diplomacy, so-called wolf warrior diplomacy surrounding COVID. And it also demonstrates that the US is going to be highly pragmatic and highly strategic in terms of the kind of range of partnerships that it develops, even though it didn't initiate this, but it clearly is very much on board. To deter China's influence in the region. So I actually think it's a more significant development. I know that in Europe, the primary concern is, you know, whether people were consulted, and, you know, that's a long, complicated story.
Especially in Paris, indeed.
But I don't think it's the main story, as it were.
And isn't it also the main story is, in the aftermath of the intense focus on what Afghanistan, we have to have a, you know, Indo-Pacific, shift the lens, move and think about something constructive as opposed to the debacle of departure. You know, I've got a number of questions here, and so I'm going to just have to grab a few of them. One of them being from Gladys Mello. It was an observation saying about China's contribution to international institutions. She observed that it's more a way to change these institutions. She referenced DPKO, the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, and the reduction of focus of human rights teams and peacekeeping missions and other other things like that. Do you want to comment on that or come back on that?
I'll say one thing on that, which is that it's a really important point. I am in no way, shape, or form drawing a moral equivalence between the United States and China, but I will say that the U.S. is also well known for maneuvering within and outside of institutions to to use them in the way that it would like to use them or to deny them influence. So that is a common game. Mm-hmm. And I guess the concern is, the strategy might be similar, and whose kind of values and politics do we like better? So it's not surprising, but it is a really important point.
Yeah, powers act in this sort of way, and so China, so others as well. A last question, Tove Duncan Jones asks, how do you think global diplomacy and trade can move forward when Xi Jinping's China is slowly resembling Mao's rather than Deng Xiaoping's approach? I'm summarizing in terms of ideology and national reforms.
Yeah. Well, personally, I'm not convinced that Xi is heralding a path-breaking change in China's economic policy. If of course the discourse is completely different compared to Hu Jintao and his generation, but the essence of Chinese policy has been dual circulation throughout. From Deng Xiaoping over Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao to Xi today. And dual circulation has always meant we engage in function of national power, right? That's the bedrock ambition that underpins everything. We trade, but we trade with the idea to make the home market stronger. We do joint ventures to get the technology from stronger companies. So the language is tougher, it's much more ideological, but what surprises me more is the surprise in the corporate world. For instance, when we consider the recent measures taken against some of the tech companies, well, if you read what comes out of the State Council or the Ministry of Information and Industry and Information Technology, for over 10 years, those documents have stated what was coming. So we do stimulate and support innovative Chinese companies, but with a responsibility with regard to national security, indigenous innovation, so Chinese technology for Chinese companies, and when that's not happening, there will be changes. So that's the beauty of China. I think for all the suspicion, it tends to be extremely transparent of what it wants, right? But oftentimes we prefer not to see it. And that goes for the corporate world and that goes for the politicians. You cannot blame the Chinese for playing tricks with us, right? I think much more of the responsibility is on our side. Like when companies enter in joint ventures, well, it suffices to read what the government has and on paper in terms of ambitions for that sector, and you know what the expectation is of a joint venture. And that again, also coming to the conclusion of this fascinating debate, is also my main finding of the last 30 years. We had our eyes wide shut oftentimes. And in this high age of information, with everything available at hand, we did do very little with it. And that's a very humbling conclusion, of course, for us as academics, but I think also for a lot of the decision makers. I would say we like to talk grand strategy but oftentimes we just muddle through, and perhaps that's inherent to international politics.
That seems to be a good point to to draw this, to make some concluding remarks and to draw this to a conclusion. That was interesting, as we seem to be, just a few observations on my part. We're reliving, if you like, Who Lost China 2.0. That was a debate, of course, in the 50s, and again, principally rooted in the United States and reflective of that. And we're now engaged in another version of that, but on a global setting as opposed to the country national setting. And in both cases, there was soul searching that went on, that amongst the institutions, the actors, decisions taken and not taken, case of the screaming obvious not being ever being recognized, at least as portrayed by critics. One wonders how one can repeat, you know, the second time it's farce, right? If one does this, one wonders how analysts, as you've just said, Jonathan, it isn't that we dropped the ball as analysts, but how analysts were not listened to in the vast data streams, or we don't know how to project our voice out there. So I think that may be some part of it. I also think that it's that the question of cleaning one's own house, putting forward a democracy, the power of electoral democracy as a point of attraction, a model, may appeal abroad, but domestically, when the inequalities that the very market-driven approach has spawned, you know, eye-watering wealth and people who feel increasingly that their generation is losing out from their previous generations, that this also is a problem. And house cleaning will of course be important to getting institutions and the appeal of democracy back on the front burner. Thank you very much, Jonathan, for presenting and contributing to this fascinating discussion. Leslie, thank you as well for your contributions and insights. It's really been a wonderful session. We've tackled some difficult issues and done so, I think, in a way that has been open-minded, learning-oriented, and can spawn, if you like, further debates and discussions. I'll put a plug in for Jonathan's book. It's a great read. You may not agree with everything, but I think it's going to make you think. And I think that's what we try to do. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone. Have a good evening. Thanks.